Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Points. Thoughts and prayers, appeals to sensible solutions on gun control, concerns about mental health, tearful candlelight vigils. These are the practiced routines America follows after yet another mass murder, even those fueled by racial hatred. Not this time, it just feels a bit different. In the days since El Paso, a great momentum has built to treat white supremacist violence as terrorism, just as authorities treat violence inspired by Islamic extremism. And we've seen the president call for a change in that policy, as well as a renunciation of hatred, even as Trump himself has been denounced for the vitriolic and sometimes racist rhetoric he has repeatedly directed at immigrants. This hour on Point, El Paso, white supremacy, the law, and the president. Join us. How do you feel about the administration's response to El Paso? How do you want murderous racist attacks to be treated? How do you view the president's rhetoric? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. To start us off, with us from Tucson, Arizona, is Frank Figluzzi. He's former FBI Assistant Director for Counterintelligence. He served as a special agent at the Bureau for 25 years and is now an NBC national security contributor. You can link to his recent op-ed, "Why Does Trump Fan the Flames of Race-Based Terrorism?" at our website, onpointradio.org. Frank, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So this op-ed really caught my eye, caught our eye here, as well as I'm sure many other folks, in part because of its date. You wrote this piece for The Times, an opinion piece, and I want to allow you to unpack it. But you wrote it, it appeared after the shooting at the Garlic Festival in California, but you wrote it before that. That is, this was an op-ed that you wrote in July. Tell us what you said and what case you were making.
Well, I basically said that all the warning signs and indicators were there for a path to violence and that we were on that path. And it comes, ironically, not from my experience in the FBI in domestic terrorism, but rather from my FBI experience with international terrorism. By that, I mean I'm seeing disturbing similarities between the radicalization process, particularly online radicalization that we've seen with Islamic violent jihadists, and what we're seeing in the white hate, white supremacy movement inside the United States. And that is that people are aligning themselves with a cause greater than themselves. They are finding like-minded people, and they are finding inspiration in a very senior, high-profile leader. Now, in the Islamic violent jihad world, there are radical Muslim clerics preaching extremism and violence. And we know who they are. We track them, we monitor them. But on the domestic terrorism side, we're seeing even the president's rhetoric moving people, inspiring people. And unfortunately, when there's unstable people, they don't see a difference between the president just saying these people with different skin color are bad and are the enemy and a violent call to action. They don't see that subtle distinction. So for those who say, well, the president didn't directly call for violence, I say that distinction is lost on these extremists.
I want to play a clip. The El Paso native former congressman from El Paso, current presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke, spoke on Sunday with CNN's Jake Tapper following the shooting. Here's what he had to say about the president.
Do you think President Trump is a white nationalist?
Yes, I do. And again, from some of the record that I just recited to you, the things that he has said, both as a candidate and then as the president of the United States, this cannot be open for debate. And you, as well as I, have a responsibility to call that out.
In that instance, I think it's interesting. I cover media for NPR. You know, it's interesting to hear that that O'Rourke is saying the media as well as political figures have to call that out on their own authority. That said, Frank Figluzzi, you know, how would you characterize the president's rhetoric, and why do you draw a line even if he's not calling for violence against immigrants. Why do you draw a line from his words, the kinds of actions that we have seen and that, in a sense, you predicted?
Well, first, I'll say, addressing both Trump and the role of the media, that we've spent a lot of time and energy debating whether or not the president is a racist. And I have to tell you that from a very practical counter-radicalization standpoint, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether he is truly a racist or whether he is simply pretending to be one on television to appeal to his base. The end result is the same. So I think we've wasted a lot of time and energy figuring out whether President Trump is a racist, and we've not spent enough energy understanding the impact of his rhetoric. And I'm here to tell you again, from my experience in international terrorism, that extremists will find soulless comfort and encouragement and have with the president's rhetoric. The president's essentially been playing with matches every day for 2 years, and now he can't be surprised that a fire has started. And the point that I'm making here that I think is important is the next step. And so you've got to put that, if a fire has started and you've been playing with matches, you got to put the matchbook down, or the house is going to burn down. And how do you put that matchbook down? Well, the president had an opportunity yesterday with a press conference, and it's my assertion that he missed the mark. He missed his opportunity to turn this thing around. So if you agree that we're on a radicalization process with these extremists, you have to understand how to disrupt it. And you disrupt it the most effectively by having that leader that they're identifying with come out and personally rebuke, reject, and condemn the ideology. And what we saw yesterday was what I call, to use a baseball term, a swing and a miss. The president could have said, could have personalized this and said, I reject, I condemn, I rebuke this, I walk away from you. And he did not. He actually instructed the nation to condemn racism.
Can we drill down on that for a second, Frank? Because it seems to me as though, you know, I've seen a lot of conservative commentators and friends have texted me saying, you know, what do you want him to do? He said hatred is wrong. We must reject it. I think he said we. You know, presumably he's included in that. To play devil's advocate, tell me why that's not sufficient.
Well, if you understand the psychology of radicalization and you take some time to learn how these people think, you understand that they feel a tremendous personal connection to the radicalizer. And in this case, let's assume for the sake of argument that it's the president of the United States. And when they, through their eyes, through their ears, when they see the, when hear the press conference from yesterday, they see someone who is reading a script. They see someone who didn't use first person active tense language, told the nation this is bad, the nation should condemn it, but didn't say I may have played a role in this, I reject it, you will no longer hear me say this, I condemn this on a personal level. He and whether he's ill served by his advisors and counterterrorism personnel in the intelligence community, or whether they're telling him how to issue a statement that will help disrupt the radicalization process, and he's rejecting that advice, I don't know. But there was a better way to present this yesterday.
At that press conference, President Trump said the nation condemns racism, the nation condemns white supremacy, and then he said this.
We have asked the FBI to identify all further resources they need to investigate and disrupt hate crimes and domestic terrorism, whatever they need. We must recognize that the internet has provided a dangerous avenue to radicalize, disturb minds, and perform demented acts. We must shine light on the dark recesses of the internet and stop mass murders before they start.
Now, late last month, FBI Director Christopher Wray testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he talked about the ways in which the Bureau addresses terrorist acts that are fueled by white supremacy.
We, the FBI, don't investigate ideology, no matter how repugnant. We investigate violence. And any extremist ideology, when it turns to violence, we're all over it. And we've had, in fact, and that you don't have to just take my word for it, you know, just in the first three quarters of this year, we've had more domestic terrorism arrests than the prior year. And it's about the same number of arrests as we have on the international terrorism side.
Frank Figluzzi, you were former assistant director for counterintelligence for the FBI for several years during the Obama years, but also was with the agency for 25 years. Would you say that approach to addressing white supremacist violence has been adequate?
No. I think there's an easy answer to that. The answer is no. But I think it's really important for your listeners to understand why that's inadequate and how we got here. So international terrorism has a body of law associated with it. We've identified groups, organizations, and individuals that are part of that problem. And the law permits law enforcement and the intelligence community to use an all-hands-on-deck approach. So you know, after 9/11, the Patriot Act was created. Literally, we created an entire institution called the Department of Homeland Security. We created a new role called the DNI, Director of National Intelligence, all in response to this clear threat. Well, we don't have anything analogous on the domestic terrorism side. So it's easy for the president to say, I've told the FBI to stop this and whatever they need. Well, this is a much greater, more complex issue. Why? Because we're talking now about ideology and free speech and privacy. So, for example, people might say, well, why isn't the FBI in these chat rooms and blogs where white hate is espoused and people are speaking of moving toward violence? Well, because they're not allowed to. They're not allowed to, and so if we're left to rely on
there were real scandals when the FBI was shown in the 70s to have been sort of investigating people for ideological reasons during the 60s and 70s.
That's right. There are quick steps to exploitation and abuse, and we saw some of it with the Patriot Act and post 9/11, and the huge controversy over collecting metadata and phone numbers for later retrieval. This is a national discussion we need to have. When does hate speech become violent speech? And the issue is, I draw this analogy. Many years ago, the Supreme Court said, "For obscenity, we know it when we see it." Mm-hmm. Well, We know violence when we see it, but now we have to enable law enforcement to be able to look. You can't address what you don't see.
We'll pick that up and more after this brief break with a historian who studied the legacy of anti-Mexican violence in Texas. We're discussing, of course, the week's deadly mass shootings, the president, and the intelligence community's response to domestic terrorism. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're taking a look at shootings in El Paso, Texas, President Trump's history of anti-immigrant rhetoric and domestic terrorism. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'll bring our guests back on in just a moment, but I want to first take a couple of calls from our listeners. First, I'd like to go to Des Moines, Iowa. Chris is calling in. Chris, thanks for sharing your thoughts today.
Hi. I wanted to call and this is Trump's base, and so he's shooting at his base. And us as the people, we have to realize his base is really a bunch of they're bigots. They embrace the bigotry that he has, and they have been embracing his bigotry all along. And so for now, for the folks in the House and especially in the Senate, to protect the president these folks are just as much as a bigot as he is, because what they're doing, they're protecting and upholding his bigotry. And so as long as this is going to be done like this, we can say whatever we want to say, all that mess that Trump said yesterday, it's just a bunch of BS, because he's unshown his true colors all along. And so for right now, he's just coming out just to say whatever he has to say to cover his behind. But he doesn't mean what he says, because he's going to continue on practicing his bigotry with the base that he has, because that's what they're for. And so anybody or until the Republicans start standing up to him and to start telling him, see, as long as you allow him to continue this madness, he's going to continue this madness. So if none of the Republicans or anything don't stand up to him, they're just as guilty as he is.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts on that, Chris. I also want to take this call from Columbia, South Carolina. L, I think it is. L, thanks for calling in today.
Yes, good day. I'm calling in. My entire family, we're Republicans, lifelong Republicans, and we believe in the Second Amendment, a lot of military in our family, but it's getting to the point where we have to speak up. Republicans have to speak up. When children are dying, when innocent people are dying while shopping for school, something other than just saying, oh, mental illness has to be done. We elect public officials to take action, and just standing up in front of a microphone saying, yes, we need to think about mental illness and we need to do this, is just not enough. It's really, really difficult to even say I'm a Republican anymore, because we're associated with bigotry, with just everything negative. It's really frustrating. Something has to be done. We should not allow people to walk in or to just communicate and buy a firearm without a background check to personal fail. There's things that we can do right now to save lives.
Thank you so much for your call, Elle. I believe South Carolina Republican Senator Tim Scott has said that he'd be willing to return to Washington for a special session this month to deal with gun control, although it's not clear exactly what proposals he would be embracing at this time. I want to bring back my guest, Frank Figluzzi. He's a former FBI assistant director for counterintelligence, and also Monica Munoz Martinez. She's joining us from Washington, D.C. She's professor of American Studies at Brown University and author of the 2018 book, The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas, as well as a founding member of the nonprofit organization Refusing to Forget, that calls for a public reckoning with racial violence in Texas. Monica, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wanted to ask you, Professor, a bit. One of the things, as I understand it, that you argue is, look, this is actually part of a rich and terrible history of racial violence against Mexicans in Texas. What are the consistent threads or notes that you've seen play out from what authorities say is the manifesto of the or statement of the killer in El Paso, with what you've researched over the decades?
Thank you. Well, it's a troubling reality that border policing today has deep roots in racial violence in the border region, especially in the Texas-Mexico border. So in the early 20th century, I study a period of racial violence in which hundreds of Mexican-Americans and Mexican nationals were murdered by law enforcement and by vigilantes in Texas. And so this included, you know, the preeminent law enforcement agent, the Texas Rangers, which are the state police officers, some U.S. soldiers, local law enforcement, but also vigilantes. And what we see in that period is that this was largely state-sanctioned, that politicians called for violence. They profiled Mexicans, regardless of whether or not they were American citizens, as threats to the nation, as inherently violent and people that needed to be policed brutally. One U.S. congressman called for Mexicans to be shot on sight. And so that led to
a period.
In this testimony was in 1919. U.S. Congressman Claude B. Hudspeth testified, actually, during an investigation into abuse by the Texas Rangers that was organized by the sole Mexican-American state legislator, José T. Canales. The atrocities had been mounting throughout the decade, but there was a massacre that occurred in 1918 of 15 men and boys in the presence of their families at the hands of Texas Rangers that prompted, finally, this investigation into abuse. But one of the lessons from this period is that, you know, that law enforcement and vigilantes enjoyed a culture of impunity. There was not accountability. People weren't prosecuted. And many of the Rangers committed these acts of violence with the knowledge that they had the pardoning power of the governor behind them. And so that also inspired vigilantes to participate in anti-Mexican violence and in murders, but also brutal lynchings. Mm-hmm. And so some of those connections that we see, what this history asks us to think about are those connections between state-sanctioned violence today and more extreme vigilante violence, like we saw the horrors of the massacre in El Paso.
The New York Times is among those outlets that's been reporting about some of the president's advertising. Since January, the New York Times writes, Mr. Trump's reelection campaign has posted more than 2,000 ads on Facebook that include the word invasion, part of a barrage of advertising focused on immigration, which is a dominant theme of his reelection messaging. How consistent is that kind of language and rhetoric with the kind of rhetoric that you found in your research over the decades of those public sentiments expressed about Mexicans and Mexican Americans by those in Texas?
Well, there are striking parallels. In the between 1910 and 1920, there were calls by politicians across the country, but especially in Texas, for the militarization of the border, for fear that Mexican bandits and revolutionaries were going to cross into Texas and murder Anglos living near the border. And so that fear that those calls for the militarization of the border resulted not only in Mexican nationals being policed along the border, but also American citizens and residents in Texas who looked Mexican being violently policed. And so what we saw was a suspension of people's civil rights. People were being denied due process. And so those calls were met with violent consequences. And so the use of that rhetoric today by the administration is shocking. It's dangerous. It leads to violence by vigilantes, by extremists, but also is leads to violence in the form of state policy, like the zero tolerance policies on the border and family separations. And so when we think about racial violence, we have to think more broadly structurally to study what are the laws that are putting this sort of racism in place that also embolden white supremacists and racists to devalue Mexican life and immigrant life.
On yesterday on MSNBC's Morning Joe, Democratic Representative Veronica Escobar of El Paso, or at least who represents El Paso, said President Trump wasn't welcome in her hometown. Here's what she had to say.
All of this has happened because the Hispanic people have been dehumanized. They have been dehumanized by the president, by his enablers, by other politicians. This is one of the lowest points in American history. And if we don't recognize this as such, we will not have the turning point that we so desperately need as a country.
Monica Munoz Martinez, how fair is it to draw a direct line between the president's rhetoric and, you know, this slaying of people at a Walmart in a heavily Latino part of Texas? In fact, you know, El Paso, the pass, a conduit for people to come to this country from that.
Well, you know, I am moved by those comments and those sentiments, and I am. You know, my heart is broken for the residents in El Paso. And I think what is deeply troubling is that because it is such a vibrant community living on the border where people think binationally, economically, politically, you know, people are united socially by families and traditions, that the kind of rhetoric that is used by the president has for a long time been portraying residents of the border region as has been dehumanizing to them, and it has misrepresented these places like El Paso as being dangerous, and using that political rhetoric to then justify the further militarization of the border and the further violent policing of people that live in that region. And we've also seen the denial of human rights for people who are seeking asylum in the United States. And so, you know, the rhetoric, I think on its own measure, needs to be judged. And then, in terms of how it manifests into policies, but also in inciting violence, you know, the calls for the president to be an apologist or to condemn racial violence. If we think historically, there were also presidents like Woodrow Wilson, mm-hmm. who were noted segregationists and racist presidents, who said publicly things that opposed, for example, lynchings in the United States, but then refused to actually enact federal policy to help curb lynchings in the United States. And so those empty words, even if it is an apology or an effort to suppress extremism, while, you know, it's important to suppress extremism, but we also need the administration to act in ending these violent practices on the border.
I want to take a call now from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim's calling in. Thanks for listening today, Jim. What are your thoughts?
Hi, David. I think, in general, terrorism is an attempt at intimidation. And I think the shooter in this case may have been trying to intimidate Mexicans from crossing the border into Texas. And it obviously didn't work. So I'm wondering, I'd like to ask your guests how effective they think domestic terrorism really is.
Thanks for your call, Jim. Frank Figluzzi, why don't you weigh in here, former assistant director for counterintelligence at the FBI. What do you make of that question from Jim?
Well, I think we can look back in history to judge the effectiveness of white hate, domestic terrorism, and we find mixed results. I mean, anyone who studies the 1960s and the Deep South understands not only the civil rights movement, but understands the fear and intimidation that was instilled in the black community, people fearful of travel, fearful of leaving their homes, fearful of going to church, churches burning down, lynchings and rapes of blacks. So, you know, you can claim that that's effective. Now, ultimately, society rejected that, moved forward, enacted laws, but government led that charge, and civil rights activists led that in conjunction with the government. So the answer is complicated, but I think the bottom line is domestic terrorism is as successful as our society allows it to be. And that includes whether or not we respond swiftly and surely, and whether or not our most senior leaders reject it. You know, your two previous callers raised a great points about the role of people around the president, the role of the Republican Party, because just as the president appears to be emboldening and facilitating white hate, those around the president, the senior Republican leadership, are facilitating and enabling him through their silence. And if they were to speak out and apply pressure to the president, he would need to listen to them because they represent his base and they are silent.
I want to play some comments. A number of those callers as well mentioned the question of the role of Republicans. In a Paso, one, an avid critic of Republicans. The second one, herself a Republican, who was, she said, troubled. Here's what Texas Republican Congressman Will Hurd had to say. His district borders El Paso. He spoke to CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday.
This is an act of terrorism. Terrorism is an act where you use violence against civilians for a political end. And initial indications suggest that this is based on race and hatred, which would be white nationalist terrorism.
Congressman Hurd is, I believe, the lone black Republican in the House of Representatives and has also announced that he will be stepping down at the end of this term, at the beginning, I guess, of 2021. Frank Figluzzi, I also wanted to mention, of course, the nation and the state of Ohio is also mourning the dead and reeling from the mass shooting in Dayton over the weekend. In Dayton, there was it appears to be some confirmation that the shooter had been following a number of liberal and leftist sites and affirming certain kinds of leftist points of view. Is there any sense that there can be a connection made there between ideological belief and the intent of the shooting from what we've learned so far?
Well, it's very, very early in the Dayton investigation, and the police are piecing all of their intelligence and investigative work together. We're beginning to see in the early stage a history, even from the shooter's youth and high school experience, reporting that indicates he had some very serious mental health issues and was reportedly creating lists of people to kill, lists of women to rape, lots of high school counseling interaction with him. So, but where here's where I see the intersection occurring, and it comes down to the guns, right? So if we're talking about the president's role in stopping this, what we heard from the president's press conference was among his five suggestions, there was nothing that directly touched on controlling the problem of guns in America. There was one suggestion regarding red flags proposal, which I'm a huge fan of, and that's empowering law enforcement to take a weapon away with due process from someone they believe is going to hurt somebody. But other than that, right, the Dayton shooter, let's look at this. The Dayton shooter had in his possession drum magazines, high capacity magazine drums, each of which would carry 100 rounds of ammo. He had enough ammo on him to strike 250 people. The president has not said word one about the easy solution of just banning high capacity magazines.
We're discussing white supremacy, we're discussing domestic terrorism, and obviously discussing the mass shootings in the wake of this weekend's events in El Paso and Dayton, Ohio. You can join our conversation. What policy changes do you hope to see in reaction to these mass shootings? What role does race play at the center of these conversations and these decisions? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're taking a look at domestic terrorism and white supremacy as the communities of Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso grapple with the aftermath of mass shootings. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Frank Figluzzi, former FBI Assistant Director for Counterintelligence, and Monica Munoz Martinez, Professor of American Studies at Brown University. Professor Martinez, you've, as I alluded to earlier, made a point of studying and drilling down on racial violence toward towards Mexicans. You know, the state of Texas, of course, it's often overlooked, not only joins Mexico, but was part of Mexico, or at least parts of it were for a long time. How has that tradition continued to the current day? How is it that you or to what degree has it been rejected, renounced, and abandoned in the way in which the people operate there and the state operates there?
Well, there have long been tensions over how to remember Texas history. So it's largely been remembered as a narrative of progress and independence from Mexico through the Texas Revolution, and then when Texas became a part of the United States, and the preceding war of the U.S.-Mexico War in 1848, which led to Mexico losing half of its territory to the United States, that was largely celebrated as progress, and progress more specifically in a with racist depictions of Mexicans being racially inferior, and so those anti-Mexican sentiments and debates that took place across the country about whether or not these territories should be included in the United States because then Mexicans would become citizens of the United States. Those debates about the racial impurity of Mexicans and their inferiority continue to shape public perceptions. This period of racial violence that I study in the late 19th and early 20th century also remind us that the depictions of the border then and the depictions of immigrants then, the legacy of those thoughts continue to shape public perceptions today. But, you know, I do want to really quickly return to one of the points that one of your caller made about the connections between deterrence and being used and echoed in this manifesto, but also the policies of deterrence. And this is something that has been practiced both by Democratic and Republican administrations since the 1990s. And deterrence policies have only led to death and to violence on the border. And so, you know, the
forgive me, when you're saying, I apologize for interrupting. When you're saying deterrence, you mean policies to deter people from coming into this country illegally, from not doing it through through formal channels initially.
That's right, that there are policies put in place, especially with the start of the Clinton administration in the 1990s, to implement deterrence policies. You know, one of these was Operation Gatekeeper, that literally funneled people who were coming to the United States through the desert and trying to deter them from coming into the United States, undocumented, by making the trip dangerous and deadly. Since the, you know, Border Patrol records reveal that since the start of the century, over 7,000 people have died trying to come into the United States. And so deterrence policies, what we're seeing now also, even more extreme policies by the Trump administration to separate families, you know, inflicting violence on people will not stop people from trying to seek safety. And so we really have to rethink our immigration and border policies and reorient them to have a humanitarian, to meet the humanitarian needs that people are facing.
Frank Figluzzi, you held a role in, you know, American law enforcement for a long time. As you hear that, how do you accommodate that with the need to enforce the laws and to have laws that that in some way regulate our borders to whatever, you know, to some fixed degree?
Yeah, there's no question that most Americans will readily agree that they want a secure border of some kind. And in fact, the Republicans seem to be throwing the phrase open borders around as a way to label all the Democratic candidates, when in fact, I don't believe one of them has uttered the phrase open border. So let's talk about root causes, which is what law enforcement officials look for. Everything else, like as Monica said, the deterrent policies are band-aid approaches. They actually have a countering effect. They don't deter. You got to look at root causes, and we're not looking at the root cause of the migration crisis, which unfortunately now has become a crisis of human rights crisis. We got to look at Central America, and we've got to come alongside our neighbors in Central America and partner with them to understand and assist and support. This is our backyard, and that's not what's going on. Instead, what we're doing is painting people as enemies. We're using the language of war when we say they are invading. We talk about building a wall, which not one square foot of new wall has been built. That's not the panacea to the problem. We're not getting to the root cause. And that's what law enforcement and intelligence officials do, is they scratch deeply down to figure out why something is happening. And we're not there yet.
I'd like to take a call from Sharon, Massachusetts, if we could. I think Brian is there on the air. Brian, share your thoughts today.
Hello. Yeah, I wanted to talk about the high-capacity automatic weapons that a lot of these killers use, no matter what their motives or mental state. You know, they could just be crazy people or very angry or motivated by hate. But it seems like a lot of people defend the right to hold and these automatic weapons with large rounds as some kind of deterrent against the U.S. government assailing its own citizens. And I'm wondering if your FBI agent there has knowledge that this sort of paranoia spiked during the Obama administration, or whether it's just always been with us.
Thank you for your question and your call. Frank, why don't you handle that one?
Well, this discussion is almost fraught with peril in a sense, because it you could carefully go down a slippery slope of somehow blaming Obama, which I've actually heard, by the way, some extremists say for what's happening now. And of course, that couldn't be farther from the truth. However, there's little doubt that in law enforcement and intelligence work, we did see a spike in extremism and this extreme ideology when we elected our first African-American president. There's no doubt about it, even the data on gun sales was startling with regard to fears that that president would institute all kinds of gun control, take our guns from us. People were arming themselves. Militia groups were growing and becoming more fervent. So, extremism is driven by fear and ignorance and hate. And we saw that happening during the Obama administration. And in law enforcement, we saw increased threats against the president, almost like never before, and people wanting to hurt him because they somehow saw him as a threat.
I want to take a call now from Dayton, Ohio. Stephanie, please share your thoughts today.
Hi. Yes, I live in the suburb of Dayton. My daughter goes to daycare downtown. I frequent the Oregon District. So still reeling from all of this. I personally am all for gun control. I don't think any citizen needs any guns, really, but I would really like to see a stop to the high-capacity ammunition, you know, being able to kill 9 people in less than 30 seconds because of our amazing police department's response. But what I keep hearing from Mike Turner and Rob Portman is that they, you know, mental health. And clearly the El Paso shooter had some mental health issues. The Dayton shooter had some mental health issues, but they don't want to actually do anything about it. I've been calling their offices all week and asking, what are you going to do about the mental health crisis then? Are you going to offer universal health care? Mm-hmm. Are you going to offer affordable access to the mental health? Because once they spout off about the mental health, nothing ever gets done. Right. I have friends who are fairly middle class who can't afford the treatment.
Uh-huh. And Stephanie, let me ask you this, just a quickly yes or no. Did any of these shootings change your mind to convince you of gun control, or were you kind of always there?
I've always been there.
Okay. Thank you for that call, Stephanie. In regard, interestingly, to her point, I remember a story, I believe, from last year when NPR reported that the president called for mental health to be a focus of gun control legislation, but at the same time was cutting federal funding for mental health issues. We've learned today that Ohio's Republican governor, Mike DeWine, has urged the Republican-led state legislature to pass laws requiring background checks for nearly all gun sales and allowing courts to restrict firearms access for people perceived as threats, that from the Associated Press. I did want to add, our producers have been doing some research on this for me in the last couple of days. But while calls for increased attention to mental health are fairly common from a number of policymakers, multiple studies that suggest that about a third of mass shooters suffered from untreated severe mental illness that are believed to have played a role in all this. I want to return to the question of race, Monica Munoz-Martinez. We've been talking, I think, with reason because of what's happened in El Paso, that not only were Latinos affected, I believe at least 7 of the dead were Mexican nationals, Mexican citizens. Do you see a tie-in to the rhetoric at a broader level in the nation from the president beyond that affecting immigrants and Latinos to what you've heard for other groups?
Well, certainly we can look at the anti-immigrant, anti-Latinx sentiment that's espoused by the president, but that is also coupled with anti-Muslim rhetoric and also the repeal of the civil rights that were gained and earned by struggles by African-Americans, by Native Americans and Asian Americans, people and Latinos who were fighting for civil rights. And so the assault on people of color in the United States is broad, and it's not only in rhetoric, but it's also in action. When I look historically, we not only have to pay attention to people's rhetoric, but we have to pay attention to the actions that they're taking and the consequences of that. And especially when people are gearing up for an election, we have to make sure that we are protecting people's rights to vote. I was also stricken by the manifesto and the sort of fear that was espoused by Mexicans voting. And that was something that historically Mexicans have been targeted with violence. for exactly that reason of exercising their right to vote in the early 20th century. Communities like El Paso and Brownsville, where there were elected officials who were Mexican-Americans or where there were Mexican-Americans voting, law enforcement was used to intimidate people from voting, and there was also the passage of poll taxes. So when we think about histories, when we think about racism and the way that it shapes daily life, we also have to think critically and work to dismantle the laws that create racist societies.
Frank, I wanted to see if we could talk a little bit about, you know, whether the argument that you made about anti-immigrant rhetoric from the president applies more broadly. You know, we've certainly seen mass shooters attack synagogues. We've seen them go into mosques, right? We've seen people attacked for identity for a number of reasons. Do you feel that rhetoric at the national level is playing into that as well, or do you think this is a separate circumstance?
I think the concept of disenfranchisement, I think the concept of the world changing rapidly around us and not understanding those changes, whether it's technology or robotics replacing you and your job, whether you're being outsourced, whether it's because we're losing our middle class and we're becoming a have and have not society. I think all of this plays into it, but I think that the president is masterfully using all of those variables and factors to his favor. And that is indeed where his base comes from. And I would assert that that's why he won the election, people feeling like he was the answer. He was an attempt to restore America to greatness. And they read into that whatever they felt they needed to read into that. And I think it's all part of an ideology of disenfranchisement that's fueling fear, anger, and hate.
So at this point, you know, Beto O'Rourke said essentially, hey, the president can't do anything constructive here. Briefly, what can the federal government do here that's useful? What is a constructive step forward?
Well, let's talk about what should be a nonpartisan, no-brainer approach to gun control. Number one, let's enforce existing gun laws. If you ask your neighbor on the street, you think we should be enforcing existing laws? Yes. What does that mean? It means giving the Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms the resources they need to get their job done. They are understaffed. It then means having a look at the data. Statistics show that over 90% to 95% of Americans want background checks for all gun purchases. President didn't go there in his press conference yesterday. There's still an ability to go to a gun show in any town in America this weekend and do a person-to-person transaction where there will be no background check on who's getting that gun. That needs to stop. Ask the average person on the street if they think you should have a 100-round drum magazine for your automatic weapon. And most will say, no, we don't need that in the civilian population. Every cop will tell you they don't want to face that on the street, but yet the president didn't address that. So there's some easy solutions. And then there's much more complicated solutions that Congress is going to have to wrestle with, which is, what is domestic terrorism? Should we be treating domestic terrorism as we do international terrorism? And where does that intersect with free speech and privacy?
You've been hearing there the voice of Frank Figluzzi, former FBI Assistant Director of Counterintelligence, as well as Professor Monica Munoz Martinez. She's a professor of American Studies at Brown University. Thanks to you both. We've been talking this hour about the tragic repercussions of racial hatred in this country. The Nobel laurate and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Toni Morrison died today. She wrote magisterially about race and the American experience. She was 88 years old. Morrison spoke to On Point in 2012 about the importance of language and why what we say and how we say it matters so much.
Language is generative. Well, it's not dead. It's alive. We're saying things. We're the only ones that do not just communicate, but shape language. It distinguishes us as species and certainly individually. What you say and how you say it matters. The degradation of language, it's turning into state language or corrupt language, shapes the person who speaks that way and shapes the person who hears it that way. But language is the distinguishing feature, one of the distinguishing features, aside from the urge to make art, that human beings have. and it can die.
Toni Morrison died today. She was 88 years old. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.